Welcome to the Farm to Table Talk podcast, where we talk about our food system from what we eat to how it's grown. I'm your host, Roger Wasson.
If it's the full story that you want about food issues, it's hard to find it unless it's in one of the few major newspapers left in the United States that allow reporters to do a deep dive, long-form story. Well, the Washington Post is clearly one of those papers, and we're happy to welcome one of those talented and, I'd say, envied reporters to our table, Peter Wariski. Peter writes about health and food issues and in a way that may not make all the subjects happy all the time, but certainly satisfies the curious and discerning readers. Peter, welcome to Farm to Table Talk.
Well, thanks for that introduction.
You know, I think there are a lot of people that are in journalism today that are a little jealous of you because it seems like you really get to take a dive. When you get on a story, you really get on a story.
Yeah, I've been around, and they let me give me a long leash. Thank God, it makes life more interesting to get that deep into things.
Well, I don't know where to start because what really got me started in getting a call into you and seeing if you would talk to me was a couple stories you've done recently on organics. Then I started looking at all the stories you've done, and gosh, there's so many things I'd like to talk about, but I think we should talk first about these organic stories that you did. One had to do with dairy, and one had to do with mislabeled grain products coming into the United States. Well, first of all, let's just kind of summarize the stories, and then we'll get into more depth on them. So the dairy story first, because I think it came first. What's the headline?
So the headline, I guess, on that story is that there's an awful lot of organic milk in the U.S. that comes from very, very large dairies, which are a new phenomenon. Many of them are in the West. And while the typical organic dairy has about 100 cows, these places have thousands and thousands, and we went out and visited one of them that had 15,000 cows. One of the things that distinguishes organic milk is it's supposed to come from animals that are grass-fed, at least during the grazing season. And we went out there and visited, and there were very, very few of those 15,000 cows out on the pasture in the several days that we visited. And then we further tested the milk, because the milk, if it comes from animals that have grazed, has different constituents, and it turns out that, you know, what we saw, the lack of grazing, also turned up in the milk, and that is that dairy is one that has milk all over the country because it sells to Aurora. It's Aurora Organic Dairy, and it sells to Costco, it sells to Walmart, and to the many Albertsons. So if you're buying milk there, you may be getting milk from Aurora Organic Dairy, which is the sort of became the subject of that story.
Well, I think what most people think of organic, they think it doesn't have, pesticides and hormones and GMOs and so forth in them. But as you're pointing out, with the case of livestock, they're supposed to spend some time on pasture. And so that's where you were digging in. What made you think that might be an issue?
Well, we sort of started out just from the very beginning of this was the editors are noticing something fairly obvious to everyone is that, boy, there's a lot of organic food for sale these days, and some companies are becoming quite rich off of this, is the organic label which the USDA gives to these companies. Is it really what it says it is? And then we started looking around, and there have been reports that some of these very large dairies were not grazing their animals as required. I mean, people who buy organic, especially organic dairy, expect that the cows are getting outside, that they're grazing. People who are really into organics recognize that animals that graze yield different milk than those that are kept inside and fed corn and soybeans. There was a group called the Cornucopia Institute, which is a watchdog group based in Wisconsin, and they had done some aerial photography at these places, and they showed, lo and behold, at several of these large dairies, that none of the cows were out at midday on a fine summer day. When they brought this evidence to the USDA, the USDA and the dairies themselves said, well, that's just one moment in time. Maybe that day, for some reason, they weren't out, whatever. And so the matter just slid, and it made me think there really is something there, but we need to dig a little farther, develop more evidence. And so we went out, and I guess we were out 9 times, and we had some aerial photography. So instead of just one point in time, we had several points in time where we saw very, very few cows. It said they had 15,000 cows, and I think the most we saw out there was 1,000 or so. And then on top, the reason why we chose Aurora is, one, it's very large. It's all over the country. And also, we could test that milk because we could pick up cartons of that milk and then have it tested. We had it tested down at Virginia Tech. And we thought between the multiple visits and the chemical tests that we could make a pretty strong case for whether or not these animals were actually grazing.
Well, and I guess when you do this test, you can come up with an idea that says, well, it looks like they're doing some grazing, but not very much, and I'm sure there must be a way to tell in the test if the animals are on pasture almost 100% versus some grain, some pasture.
What you could see is that there's two substances that are very high in animals that are grass-fed. One is conjugated linoleic acid, also called CLA, and there's, of course, the omega-3 fats, which everybody is familiar with from health food packaging. They're a desirable fat for many people. And the grass-fed also has lower amounts of omega-6, because omega-6s come into the cow's diet through grain. And so if they're eating grass, they're not getting grain. And so the omega-6 are fairly low. So lo and behold, when we looked at a small farm up in Maryland that does exclusively grass-fed, you know, they had very high omega-3, very high CLA, and very low omega-6. And we looked at some other organic milks, and they were not quite as high in the good things, but they were relatively high. And then we looked at conventional milk, and they are, of course, low in omega-3 and CLA. And then Aurora fits in. They measured up looking quite a bit like conventional milk, not organic.
You know, I can't help but wonder about cattle that maybe don't get out on pasture, but they're still eating pasture feed. You know, hay basically is pasture feed. So, you know, you could be in a barn in Minnesota or Wisconsin someplace where they can't get out on pasture because, you know, the snow's too deep. So they're in the barn. But if they're just eating forage, haze, for example, that's from, you know, cut grass and cut pasture, alfalfa, clover, and so forth, does that affect those tests any?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's a big difference.
Yeah,
If they're in the barn eating corn,
it'll show up in the milk.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, anyway, I'm probably the only one that's even curious about that particular question, but I want to back up because this is, when you plunge in like this, back at this idea where it came up, do you have a meeting or a brainstorming session with other reporters or your editors that something like the fact that organics are, where's all this organic coming from because it's growing so fast? I mean, could you kind of paint that picture to me? Does everybody say, let's all get together around the whiteboard?
Yeah. No, it's just me and my editor. And
oh, okay.
We've worked together for a long time, like known each other since we both started here at the Post almost the same week in 2001. He and I work well together. He's been, he follows financial trends probably closer than I do. And he's just been interested in organic foods for a while. And we had finished one project, and he said, you know, what about these organic foods? It just seems like there's something there. And it was just, we didn't know. And then so it just looked like something we would look at. We didn't know if we would actually write any stories. And then, you know, I come around, I look, and you look at some of the work that activist groups have done, and it was suggestive of, you know, deeper problems that we could maybe try to investigate. And that's where it begins. It's very, in our case, because we've been working together so long, it's pretty informal. I pop into his office and say, hey, what about this? And he'll come by and say, you know, well, what about that?
So then do you just get to clear the deck and not do other stories for a while? You don't have to write other stories while you're working on this particular story?
Pretty much. I mean, we get different, sometimes things will pop up that I'll have to jump on. And then there's other times when, I just run around and do whatever I want within, you know, the subject that I'm on.
Well, that sounds pretty inviting. So you got this story. You start doing the research, and you're plunging in. Now, do you pull in interns or others to help you draw the research that you need, or are you having to do most of that research yourself?
It's almost all me. Mm-hmm. I'd love to have interns, but and sometimes I'm able to, you know, get some help on things, especially. If I'm looking for, say, research papers or statistics, I have people within the building here that I can go to.
When you start doing this, and then you get the research and you're starting to outline that, then you had to, you start making trips and you had hired an airplane or something to fly over the fields. And that's pretty exciting.
Yeah, that was fun. That's kind of a new thing that I noticed. That photographers and now in all the newspapers, big newspapers are using drones.
Ah.
I mean, we actually had two different kinds of aerial photography because we worked with a company called Digital Globe, which I think they provide the imagery for Google Maps. But anyway, they're constantly taking pictures of the Earth, and it's high resolution, so that. We gave them the coordinates, and they were able to show us the pasture on a certain day. But we also had one of our own staffers, one of our video people, went out and flew a drone for two or three days out at Aurora, which is a great way to see it because it's 6,000 acres and nothing like a bird's eye view, and they could fly on like a satellite, you know, fairly low. They're a couple hundred feet or so up in the air.
Well, that's interesting. So again, you have to convince the editor or whoever says, listen, I want to fly this guy out there. You're going to spend a couple $1,000 on that, and he's got to take his drone. Now, is this something you have to get the cooperation of the dairy, or can you just fly up above the land and take pictures? Typically.
I think, you know, there are definitely rules that those guys know that you have to have a license to do it, and in order to get the license, you have to learn all that FAA rules regarding these things. And I think they might have just been flying over the roads mm-hmm. that crisscross the dairy. I can't remember if they actually flew directly over any of their fields. But anyway, there's roads every half mile or so, so it wasn't an issue.
What seems pertinent to this story, Peter, is that but there's more and more interest in the livestock and whether they're outside or not. You know, as you know, there's cage-free chickens, for example, and some of the same sort of stories have come up and say, did they really go outside? You know, is it such a good deal they're in cages, and how often do they go outside? But now that is open to more people. I mean, reporters like you can do it, and others, I would think so too. This almost makes me feel like perhaps this is something, you know, the government agencies will do if they're concerned about it, or if they're going to be having people certifying different kinds of operations. Maybe they're going to be using drones more too to substantiate the claims that the animals are getting outside.
That's a great idea. I doubt that from what I've seen of the organic inspection process, there's not many that motivated mm-hmm. To do that kind of work.
I wonder, though, if stories like yours doesn't cause motivation.
I'd like to think so, but I haven't seen any sign that it does. I mean, I think, as you know, the organic operator hires their own inspection agency or certification agency, and so basically the inspector is the employee of the inspected. So there's a little bit sort of obvious conflict of interest there.
Well, they get to pick out their favorites, I suppose, but they are, I believe, kind of deputized by the USGA to be agents.
Correct.
To do inspection.
Not anyone can be a certifier, and yeah, they have to be inspected by the USDA, but they're still a business. And if you, you know, if you want to keep that client, you don't want to shut them down.
Well, let's go to another one you went into recently, and this is Grain Story, and it took a bigger plane ticket than the other, than this first one. This first story, you're looking at the organic claim that might not be true. You had to fly somebody to Colorado, but you went all the way to Asia on this other story, if I'm not mistaken, on some product that was identified as organic, that was grains. Did it, like, start in Europe or somewhere and go to Asia and then come to the United States, and somewhere along the line it became organic?
Right, yeah. That story was a long time in gestation, and we took several stabs at it, and one of the virtues of taking a lot of time on stuff like that, you can sort of poke around and finally find the right way to go at a story. And that story just began with this question we had about how well the USDA system does in detecting fraudulent organics foods coming in from overseas. And we'd heard, you know, issues arising out of China. And so I was on a trip to China for something else, and visited a few, several organic operations over there, and talked to the people about the challenges that they faced there. But we pulled public records on some of the pesticide residue testing that's been done on USDA organic farms in China.
So did you go to Shandong province?
Yeah.
So Shandong is on the coast, and it's very similar. It's kind of their California in a way. A lot of food is produced in Shandong province. One thing that struck me in that story, you were identifying that how pollution has such an impact there. And I hadn't really thought of it quite that way, but when you're looking at organics and trying to keep pesticides out and so forth, In China, the pollution's so bad, it's pretty hard to keep from having contamination of heavy metals, cadmium, arsenic, lead, mercury, all kinds of chemicals that are in the water and in the air. So I would suspect they would just have a harder time even trying to do this legitimately. And I mean,
yeah, it's almost sad because I talked to this guy who has a ginger plant and a ginger farm, and from what I could tell or what I could gather, they actually do grow the ginger in an organic fashion, no pesticides. I asked him if he sold it to the United States, and he said he couldn't in good faith because, you know, you pull the ginger root up out of the ground and you wash it off. And as soon as you wash it off with the water that they have available there, it has so much pesticide residue left on it that it doesn't meet USDA standards. And so this poor guy who does grow it organically can't sell it organically, at least in the United States, because of the polluted water.
Well, it's a terrible, terrible problem in China, and so many things are polluted. And I think another terrible problem in China is maybe its history of more mislabeled product than, I don't know if it's the champion of mislabeling, but there's it's not unusual. At least that's been the story. Perhaps it's improving. But in your story, you found that it wasn't. That there was product that originated somewhere else and went through China, and somewhere along the line it became identified as organic, but it wasn't, and it hadn't been originally. Is that
Right. True. You're right, except that the product that we ended up writing on, that's why I was mentioning all the different stabs we took. So we did this China trip, and we talked to the ginger guys. But the other shipments that we dealt with didn't go through China. They came from Ukraine or Romania, then went through Turkey, and then came to the United States. Those millions of pounds of corn, three shipments, corn and soybeans. And what was unusual about that is that when you trace the records back on each of those three shipments, they were just regular organic corn, regular corn rather, and regular soybeans, and that sometime between Turkey and the United States, they became organic corn and soybeans, and somebody made millions of dollars by relabeling them.
Did anybody do a good job of trying to explain that to you, or did it just seem very, very obvious that it was wrong?
It was obvious that it was wrong. I got some interviews where people would assert one thing and then assert another. I'm not exactly clear where the relabeling happened, but, you know, just judging by demeanor, you could tell people weren't really being forthcoming, and some people would refuse to comment at all. And there's an ongoing USDA investigation into some of this.
Well, that kind of brings up the other question I've got. Do you find that when you do stories like this, have you been able to trigger investigations?
Yeah. I mean, obviously, in some things that I've written about, it's led to, you know, anything, congressional hearing, criminal action, things like that. On terms of the organic stuff, I know that, for example, one of the largest USDA certifiers has said we're going to up our standards for organic imports, and you've got to show us much more documentation if it's coming in from Turkey. And there have been changes at some of the companies that I wrote about. I haven't sort of done a full follow-up. I haven't done any follow-up, really, on the story yet, but at some point we'll report on the various issues that have come up, and these issues did come up at a congressional hearing actually recently, where the Secretary of Agriculture was asked about these reports, whether USDA actually does anything to prevent it from happening again. You know, that I haven't seen.
Well, I'm wondering, when you do a story like this, have you done some readership surveys? Are you learning and getting some way to gauge how interested people really are or care about these issues that you're raising?
They care a lot, and we don't have to do surveys now in the age of clicks, because we know at any given moment how many people are reading those stories, and we got tremendous readership on both the milk story and the organic import story. And not only that, just big numbers. I also got like hundreds of emails from people asking questions, saying this was my experience, or, you know, thanking me for the story. I got a letter from a Chinese importer who said, I'm so glad somebody told this story. I can't publish my name, but what you said is exactly what is going on over here. It's a real problem. So we've gotten a really good response to the stories, both from readers, but also from readers who happen to be involved in the trade.
Peter, that must feel great. I mean, you know, you're doing something that you can get a paycheck from, I assume, from working there, but that has to feel awfully rewarding when you're getting feedback like that, that you're connecting with people and saying, thank God somebody's actually telling this story.
Yeah, no, it's wonderful. And we sometimes joke this job is sometimes so much fun that we'd do it for free, but don't tell anybody that.
Well, that's a good sign, though. The other thing, too, is not only are you connecting with people, and again, I'm impressed with how you're connecting with people. I look at the comments that I've seen online, about what you've written, and I think, wow, you're touching people that are thoughtful, both sides of the issue, but you're really, it's causing them to take it up a notch. Do that sometimes make you say, look, we need to go another round because there's so much more interest here?
Yeah, I mean, we're definitely going to do more in this area of organics. You touched on the livestock, and I don't know if you talked about regarding poultry or just livestock in general, but we have another story that I hope to do in that area. We have another one on additives to organic food that are not organic, and a few others planned. But I suppose it helps to get good feedback, and that's one of the reasons we do them.
Yeah. Well, and I think you're in Washington, D.C., too, and I've gone to Washington quite a bit, and I've never been in an office that didn't have the Washington Post. What is the life of a story like this? You print it in the Washington Post. How do you see these stories getting dispersed after your initial publication?
You just continue to get letters about them for years based on the initial enthusiasm that, you know, these organic ones could be fall in that category as well.
There's a lot of people that are discouraged and worried about the state of newspapers and the role that they can play, because so many newspapers seem to have a hard time maybe competing with the internet. I'm curious, what makes you more optimistic? I mean, what makes you feel more positive? What do you see in the near future from doing what you're doing and doing reporting as associated with a newspaper that you know can continue to kind of raise the bar?
I mean, I doubt anyone would call me an optimist on this, but you know, obviously we're on the internet, so we're not competing with it. The great problem for newspapers has been that print advertising paid more than internet advertising. So as we make the transition to the internet, we've got to figure out ways to sort of stay afloat. So far, they seem to be doing it. I'm not quite sure how, but they're doing it, and I'm allowed to do this sort of thing.
You talked about some of the stories that intrigue you looking ahead. You mentioned a story on poultry. What are the kind of other issues would you hope to tackle, or do you think are going to be coming up in this next year?
Well, I mean, we've got those forthcoming stories, one about how the USDA organic program regulates poultry and how they're kept and whether or not the animals ought to be able to get outside. There's been this huge shift in which, rather than letting them go outside, the large, very large companies with millions of chickens, they keep them inside but let them out on what they call porches, which are caged in small areas of the barn. That's one thing. But I think that, you know, the things to watch are these advisory board meetings that come up every 6 months for the organic program. And that's where all, you know, anyone from the organic community can come in and sort of give their input for where the USDA program ought to go. And that, I think there's one in November in Jacksonville. That'll be pretty interesting because a lot of these issues are brewing. You have, you know, small dairy farmers who are upset about the very large dairy operations that we wrote about that may not be meeting the actual organic standards and putting economic pressures on these little guys. You have grain farmers, corn and soybean organic farmers in the U.S. who are upset that fraudulent organics from other countries, particularly Turkey, have been let in and depressed their prices. And there are other sort of sore spots for many organic players in the organic industry in the United States, and those get expressed at these advisory board meetings. And November will be an interesting one of those meetings, I think.
Seems like you should be there.
Hope so.
You better
ask your
editor friend. Because I think one of the things keeps brewing that you're alluding to here is that there's more and more concerns about the really large operations as organic scales, and what started out as small scale, how do they compete with some of, and you've described this with the dairy in Colorado, for example, and you're alluding it to it, I think, even with the poultry industry. And the other is the imports from other countries and whether they're at the same standards as we are. So there's probably plenty to keep an eye on.
I think so.
Yeah. Well, Peter, I really appreciate what you do. You do a tremendous job of writing these deep stories and getting so much into them. And we're lucky to have papers like the Washington Post that are allowing this type of journalism to take place. Thank you for being on Farm to Table Talk.
Sure. Thanks for having me. It's fun.
You've been listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson. If you like what you hear, go to farmtotabletalk.com and follow us on SoundCloud, Facebook, and Twitter, or go to iTunes to subscribe and give us a review and a rating. Thanks for listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.